organizing committee and Astrid in particular for the invitation to give this review talk here at Loops. And sorry to all those here who already know this stuff. It will be a lot of repetition for reasons, you know. But, I will try to put some emphasis on general ideas rather than technical details. So hopefully it stimulates some discussion. And yes, please interrupt me anytime you want for questions. So yes, so the general outline of the talk is going to be to introduce motivations and general ideas of asymptotic safety for those who are not familiar with the idea. Then I will review what are the techniques we use to test this scenario of quantum gravity, and give an overview of results. And then I will conclude with discussing a couple of practical and conceptual open questions. So first of all, what is asymptotic safety? It's a proposal for a quantum gravity scenario in the framework of quantum field theory, which was proposed by Weinberg at the end of the 70s. And it kind of goes against the most popular view, which is that gravity is different. And so it shouldn't be thought as a quantum field theory at the ultimate level, at the fundamental level. However, as you already saw from this morning, there's some people who don't give up on this. And so, and this is basically the purpose of the asymptotic safety program is to check whether there is a way out. And the idea is that asymptotic safety offers a rescue scenario for quantum theory of gravity, which has not been ruled out. And it is it has an appealing feature, which is gravity is not different somehow. So for some people this is appealing, for others it's boring, but that depends on your point of view. I think whatever your belief is on quantum gravity, this option is still open, so it's good to investigate and check whether that's realized or not. Last but not least, there is quite some supporting evidence now, and so it makes the question even more important. So let's say what is this scenario. That's one conjecture which has two essential aspects. One is that the idea is that the quantum theory of gravity is defined by a UV stable, also known as relevant trajectory of a non-trivial fixed point of the normalization group. This sounds very jargon maybe for people who are not used, but it just means that there is a trajectory of the normalization group which goes to a fixed point in the UV, which is not the free theory. And this, I would argue, allows to define a continuum limit of a quantum field theory, even in the non-normalizable case. The second aspect is that the space of such trajectories should be finite, should be finite dimensional, possibly low, but not zero. And this, the dimensionality of this space, it counts the number of free parameters that you have in your theory.
When you say allows to define a continuum, what do you mean? You live in the continuum.
Well, to define a continuum limit of a quantum field theory. So, you start with a regularized theory and you want to define a continuum limit in the sense. Anyway, this is really what comes here. So, this comes really from this wonderful lesson that from Ken Wilson, that a continuum QFT is defined by a fixed point of the normalization group and its relevant directions. The idea is that however you regularize your QFT, the way to take the continuum limit is to tune the Bayer theory to a phase transition with diverging correlation length, so that any dependence on this arbitrary UV regularization will be washed away. And this is then because this phase transition with divergent correlation length are known as second order phase transition or continuous phase transition. And one property of this phase transition is universality, which basically says that only few interactions characterize the resulting theory from this continuous limit procedure. And I would like to emphasize that no scale, so when you, the idea of doing this continuum limit is that this way, no fundamental scale, no fundamental cutoff is introduced a priori. Nevertheless, scales do arise in this limiting procedure, and they come from the boundary conditions that you have to impose for this relevant trajectory. An example, a standard example is lambda QCB, which comes out this way. Finally, it is important to test this scenario. What we do usually is to let run all the couplings, which are needed to determine the universality classes. And this is an independent question from practical usefulness of the running coupling itself. I will come back to this later, but just so this is the general idea. And of course, there's a couple of caveats. It's not that always this procedure can will go smooth. There is you have to be careful that first of all, you have the fixed point theory, and the theory that you get in this scaling limit is a good one. For example, you have to think about unitarity. And next, you have to also think of even if this is true and you are safe and your theory is unitary and everything, it still doesn't mean that end of the story. Of course, you have to go and check in the real world whether this is what is realized, whether there are no new degrees of freedom entering before you reach the fixed point regime, whether you are on the UV critical surface. So in a sense, you could still find out that there are even non-perturbed, living non-renormalizable interactions. So that means you will be a bit out of the UV stable surface and you wouldn't hit the fixed point in the UV. So you would be again in a similar situation as we are at present for the perturbative case. Now, so a few more words about the general idea. So a pretty, so in the continuum limit, the final fixed point, as I say, the only three parameters are those associated with this IR unstable or UV stable linear perturbations, which and this continuum procedure that I was describing basically something like you can think of something like this. You have a UV stable surface or spanned by this relevant directions. Here, my arrows go towards infrared. So they go away from the fixed point in the infrared, and you have irrelevant directions, which instead are attracted by the fixed point in the infrared. So you, wherever you start with your directions, the limiting procedure needs to tune to the space spanned by the irrelevant directions, which is typically is associated to some phase transition. And in this in the limiting procedure, you are left with the actually with a trajectory which emanates from the fixed point, and is called the renormalized trajectory, or sometimes also perfect action. An important point here is that, as I was saying, that this surface of relevant directions be finite dimensional, because then you have a finite number of free parameters, and that means predictive theory, which was one of the problem of dealing with quantum gravity as an effective field theory, that you have to fix at every order perturbation theory new free parameters. So it kind of limits the predictivity of the theory. So the advantage here is that instead you'll expect to have only a finite number of free parameters. So having said that, how do we test this idea? How do we try to check whether this is true or not? Well, let me first remind what is a Gaussian fixed point and how we test that. Is the first of all, you need to discuss this. You need beta functions, which are the function that tells you how couplings, dimensionless couplings, run. So I take some quantities with tilde would be defined in units of the running scale k. So if ui has dimension di, then I divide by k to the di. And beta functions, this k decay of u tilde, will generally be given by a three-level part and some plus quantum corrections. As you see, generally this starts with a linear order in u, and then you always have the trivial fixed point where all these couplings are zero. And this corresponds to having no interaction terms in the action, and that's why you will be left only with a free theory, and the free theory is a Gaussian measure in the path integral. So that's why we call it a Gaussian fixed point. In that case, things are very easy, and critical exponents are just given by the dimension of the of these couplings, and they tell you, so critical exponents tell you how the fixed point, the stability properties of the fixed point. And trivially they are real exponents, and the relevant directions correspond directly to the usual renormalizable interactions, power counting, from power counting argument. And there are finally many relevant couplings. As you move to the non-trivial case, then comes the question, how do you decide whether there is a non-trivial fixed point? So first, if you use perturbation theory, what you are looking for is for the zeros of a function, which you know in a kind of a series expansion. So you're looking for zeros of a function from its asymptotic expansion at the origin. And so it's not, it's generally difficult to infer whether there is a zero node. You need to go systematically to high order, and you need also resummation methods. And for the case of gravity, this is very difficult because it's difficult to go beyond one or two loops. So we are very limited on this. Another option is to use to look for other expansion parameters. And this is standard when one does dimensional continuation and look, for example, look models in 2 plus epsilon or 4 minus epsilon. Or if you have n matter fields or some ON model, etc., you can look for a 1 over n expansion. Then another standard method is the lattice one. Because fundamentally, this is a non-perturbative question, but because I was saying the non-trivial fixed point means that you have an interacting theory and the coupling can be large, so it's fundamentally a non-perturbative question. And lattice is a very important non-perturbative tool. And what one does there to look for, to connect to this scenario, is to look for second-order phase transitions, which are usually related to the to non-trivial fixed points, as I was discussing before. Finally, there is this method of non-perturbative expansion or truncations of exact RG equations, and which has many applications. Now, let me briefly see how each of these goes for gravity. Well, this 2 plus epsilon expansion has been the first method that has been used for this to test this scenario. So from the end of the 70s and up to the 90s, the Cavalli and collaborators had a lot of extensions of this. One finds that in 2 plus epsilon dimension, the beta function for Newton's constant takes this form. So it has a linear term which vanishes when you go to dimension 2, so to epsilon equals 0. And that has in two dimension gravity. Is trivial and it's kind of the critical dimension for Newton's constant. It's where Newton's constant is dimensionless. And then this is the one loop contribution with C central charges matter. And you see that you find a fixed point for this function which has, looks like this, positive epsilon, starts positive, and then there is a negative contribution here for C less than 25. So will go like this, and you'll find the fixed point at order epsilon. because epsilon is small, this calculation is trustable somehow. Another method is to, as I was saying, the one over n expansion, and this was first applied for gravity by Smolin in 82, and more recently by Verkacci. And there what you find is that if you couple, for example, n Dirac fields, and rescale the gravitational action with n, you find that you find a asymptotic safety for the couplings of the cosmological constant and Newton's constant, and asymptotic freedom for the Weyl square term. So, so this is a partial also so support of the asymptotic safety in this sense. Then there is the lattice models, which Renata will be talking about, and the, known as causal dynamical triangulations. And the nice news there is from recent years, 2005, and more recently, 2011 and 2012, they found a second order phase transition between two phases, one of extended geometry and one of crumpled geometry phase. So kind of geometry with a background and geometry with a phase with no background. And this is also very encouraging, but you will hear more about from Renata, I guess. Then what I will be discussing now is this other method of truncations of functional normalization group equations. And so the main tool here is, you've seen it already this morning from Frank's talk, is this functional normalization group equation, which takes this form here, phi as all the fields in your theory, and RK is a cutoff which implements the Wilsonian renormalization group picture. So essentially, it's an infrared cutoff, which and what you the equation tells you how your effective theory of scale K varies with the as you vary the cutoff. The structure is quite simple, and that's why this form of the equation has become quite popular, is that it is basically like a one-loop equation, just that the in the loop you have the full propagator rather than just the free theory. And general idea behind this equation is that you start from some initial condition, say at some scale lambda, with some initial action, which you can think of as the bare action. And then as you integrate down, as you go to k equals zero, you will recover the full effective, the standard effective action. And this is totally, formally is totally equivalent to the standard, what we do. Usually, indeed, a formal solution of this, you could say, is the path integral for this initial condition with a cutoff addition. The important point is that here we look how the equation depends on this IR scale K, but the idea is always in the background that we want to remove this any UV regularization or so. And this is possible if the flow can be continued to K to infinity. So what we'll be looking for is solutions which can be continued to K to infinity, and usually this typically requires a fixed point. The application of this equation to gravity was really started by Reuter in 96. And it's thanks to the structure of this equation, which is kind of a one loop looking equation, also the formalism is very similar to standard one loop quantum field theory quantization of gravity. So you introduce gauge fixing, further proof of cost, and all that. I don't go through the details. The only two essential ingredients which are crucial for this formalism is the background field method, which means that we decompose the full metric underscore G is a background metric G mu nu plus fluctuation H mu nu. When you do that, you obtain in general an effective action which depends on two fields, G and H. And this you can always decompose as a part which depends on the full sum, so on the original full metric, plus a piece which depends independently of the two. The important thing that about this method is that this is this action now is invariant under diffeomorphisms that transform both the fields G and H as ordinary tensors. So if now if this term here vanishes, you get an action gamma k of G and zero, which contains all the info and all the information, and it provides a diffeomorphic effective action, where you have to think of this background G as the full metric. So it's a trick to obtain a diffeomorphic effective action. The reason why this is used usually is this property that gamma hat is zero is ensured in dimensional regularization, and this powerful aspect of perturbation theory. In general, it's not preserved by when using a cutoff, which is unfortunately what we need to do a non-perturbative calculation of this sort. And if there was Codello around, he was supposed to give a talk about this issue, but unfortunately he canceled it. Here you could formally it's just a parameter. It's a parameter that enters in this cutoff. In general, it's a parameter which it's a dimensionful parameter, a scale, which kind of you can think of associated to the Wilsonian point of view or integrating or momentum shell between some UV scale lambda and some IR scale k. And so how it's introduced in the thing is, again, yeah, this is the second point here of why it's important, the background field method in this to implement this Wilsonian construction. Now the background is also essential to define, to introduce this scale splitting. So the cutoff, it will be a function of the background Laplacian and of K. So K will suppress modes respect to the background Laplacian. Okay, I have to go a bit faster. Then what you do with this is, of course, you compute the second for the equation. You need the second variation of gamma respect to the fields. You plug it into the equation and project on the background to extract the beta functions. In general, what you in order to do this, you need approximation because the equation I showed you, it's formally it's exact, but you don't know how to deal with it. So what you do is usually you expand the action into a number of invariants and you truncate the expansion, keeping only a finite number of terms. And you plug these answers into the equation and obtain something that looks like this. The left-hand side is trivially just scale derivatives of the couplings. And on the right, from the functional traces, you will obtain a series that you have to truncate to match the answers. Here is the approximation where you truncate this series, which otherwise will contain all the terms. From this, you obtain beta function for dimensionless couplings, and which in general are non-polynomial functions of the coupling. So here it's to stress that it's not perturbative in the coupling expansion. And the idea is that you will repeat this for several n, and look for stability of these results. In a sense, this is what you would like to do also in perturbation theory, but it turns out that to do it in this way, it's easier than to do it on a loop expansion. So it's besides being non-perturbative in the coupling, it's also though technically somehow easier than the loop expansion. Because fundamentally, because everything looks always like a one loop calculation, just that you take a more complicated action. Instead of complicating things by adding loops, you complicate things by taking more complicated actions. So, okay, for gravity, let me skip the details. So you just go through all these, compute beta functions, look for zeros, and compute critical exponents. Now, with these methods, a number of a large number of results has been obtained over the past 10 years or so. So for the case of pure gravity here, we have particular a lot of results about polynomial expansions of the function or the effective action polynomials in the Ricci scalar to order n. So there was original Einstein-Hilbert calculations. So there has been many. Then around 2007, this was extended to order 6 and to order 10. And more recently, to order 34, so up to order R to the 34, and Kevin Foltz will be talking about that, I think not today, but one of the next days. With Frank and Pedro, we added to the n equal to truncation, also a wide square term. And there has been work by Astrid and others on the running of Gauss action. There's been work with the inclusion of boundary terms. First order formulation with running in the parameter, Lorentzian extension, matter, various type of matters inclusions, so on. And as I was saying recently, there is some new developments in the direction of taking into account this breaking of different invariants in the effective action. All this, I cannot make justice to all this. Just to summarize in one slide, to say that it provides a consistent picture of a non-trivial fixed point with a finite number of relevant directions, typically 3. What I've been working a bit over the last year is trying to extend this into the direction of going to infinite dimensional coupling space, because there are a number of questions that one would like to see addressed, that is what happens if the number of couplings in the truncation goes to infinity. Do truncation converge to a solution of the functional flow? Does the number of relevant directions grow? And how to reject spurious fixed point that you find more and more as you increase the truncation? Now, this here is important insight from Tim Morris in the 90s, who answered all these questions in the case of scalar field theory in a derivative expansion to second order, and actually even to zeroth order, to just what is known as the local potential approximation, where you just keep a generic function of phi and just a simple kinetic term with a constant in front. That already you learn a lot, and you can answer within that approximation to these questions. So what I inspired by this, I've been looking at this f of r approximation, which we studied with Francesco Caravelli, we suggested to use as an analog of this LPR approximation, where you take as an effective action just an integral of f of r Lagrangian. And now, of course, this is also what you do when you study polynomial truncations. And so you can go with this to higher order, as I was saying. Kevin will be talking about that. Or you can try to study this without truncating and numerically look for fixed point solutions, that is global solutions of the ordinary differential equation that you obtain from the functional RG equation once you plug in these answers. And Tim will be talking about this in a moment. I think it's interesting that even on general grounds, we are still waiting for this numerical result. Something general can be said about this under mild hypothesis, that in particular, that if a global fixed point solution f star exists, then the full effective action computed going to integrating down all the modes at the fixed point would be an R squared type of action, that the critical exponents are real, they form a discrete spectrum, and the number of relevant directions is finite. So this is very general properties that follow from the structure of the equation, just taking this answer. So it's already answered some of these questions I was raising before. However, of course, it relies on the assumption that there is a fixed point, so for that I postpone to Tim's talk. So then the question usually I am asked, by especially by loop people, is what to do with it, because you have no perturbation theory. Well, that's true in the sense we have no perturbation theory around the free theory. In some sense, we do some kind of perturbation theory. When we want to compute the critical exponents, there you are really linearizing around the fixed point. And But however, so you're doing some kind of perturbation, but the result is non-perturbative in the sense that it does not rely on being close to the free theory. And of course, it would be except if it wasn't for the truncation. However, we want to do also more than that. An idea which maybe Frank mentioned already this morning is that, of course, being on this UV critical surface, it means that the parameters will be, as I said before, there's only a finite number of free parameters. And this means that if you study a low energy effective field theory expansion, all the couplings you get in this effective field theory are not free and independent, but they are related to each other, and you have only, say, a few number of free parameters. So that is one way which hopefully one day will be able to extract some information. Finally, I think one would like to integrate towards the IR and see if there are no perturbative effects there, which could be relevant for cosmology. All this is harder. So most of the work that has been done now is rather on the lines of what Frank discussed this morning, which is to identify to RG improve an action using the running couplings and identify a scale K with some physical scale. I think a talk by Amber this week maybe criticizing this point of view, that whether this was my comment before, that whether this running G is useful in practice or not, it is actually skin dependent. So how to associate it to a physics is can raise some doubts. However, this has been applied to many things. Actually, there are many interesting results, and in cosmology and black holes, you heard this morning, and I think Astrid will be talking about possible connection with the CDT, looking at spectral dimensions. Finally, also other applications to particle physics, and So I'm also. So the last thing I want to discuss is whether. At the end of all this, this is really it's really safe in the sense we haven't. So we have assumed that there is we have conjectured that there is this fixed point, and all the work has been going in verifying the existence of this fixed point. However, as you heard already, the question which comes up very often is whether this fixed point will be fine or not, particularly whether it will be unitary. And this, here I build on some discussion I had with Tim, from whom I learned this argument that a finite K, because K is an infrared cutoff, you expect the theory to be quasi-local, meaning that that it emits a derivative expansion. Now, when you send K to infinity, the local Bayer theory. You get a local theory at the fixed point. And then one might, so what was my worry here is that the local theory has a most finite number of higher derivative terms. And so you can, the question of unitarity becomes very important. And there is the danger that having only a finite number of higher derivatives, you violate on unitarity. However, in particular, one would expect that from locality and conformal by invariance at the fixed point, you would have the only action I know is the vice square action, and then you get in troubles with unitarity. However, from the lunch discussion, we had I just changed this a bit, and with the lunch discussion with Tim and Astrid. So what really matters for unitarity is not gamma for k that goes to infinity, but the full effective action for gamma of k that goes to zero. And there, non-locality is the standard outcome. And so you really need to study the two-point function for the full action and see what happens there. And that is, at the moment, not done yet. There are a number of possible other way outs. Maybe the fixed point is topological. I think maybe Mercedes, Sebastian, or maybe even Kirill will mention this possibility. Alternatively, maybe there is the Hauweil invariant theory could be some kind of dilaton gravity theory. Then I think there will be a talk also about this. Finally, we had an argument with Frank and Pedro, which built up on previous arguments by Salam and Stratley and by Florianini and Percacci, that suggests that the ghost might be decoupled in an asymptotically safe theory of gravity. In particular, the ghost mass goes to infinity at the fixed point rather than to zero. So the ghosts are not propagating it in the fixed point theory. And this suggests that the fixed point action is actually it's not a Hauweil square action, which has zero mass for the ghosts. So ultimately, anyway, this is just calls for a better understanding of the fixed point theory. And it's an open question. So I just leave you with a conclusion. Thank you.
Several times with CDT, but I was under the impression that this phase diagram they draw in CDT, now they are comparing it more with Korabalivshitz. So should we expect that computations which come out of results which come out of CDT are relevant for this, or should they be relevant for Korabalivshitz?
I think it's open still. Well, of course, Renato will talk about it. Frank already mentioned something today. I guess in principle you could have both scenarios there. Well, you could have a subspace of theory space, which is the isotropic theory.
Do you expect
to
describe an asymptotic
safe
gravity or a
Korabalivshitz
gravity?
That's
right.
I understood.
That's right. The framework is sufficiently broad to accommodate both of the situations. One thing we are doing, of course, is the framework is quite different from what we're trying to represent from what we do. We're trying out to compute, actually, have lots of computation of renormalization.
So this phase diagram, which looks
a
lot...
In the phase diagram that he showed, we are trying to compute how things go as a function of scale, but of course it requires identifying certain objects they have with us. And it's not completely clear, but we hope to be able to say something more than about this continuity.
Okay, and I also had a second question.
Okay, we're running a little late, so just one question, yes?
All right, so you mentioned actually as you increase the number of n, so the dimensionality of your center doesn't change. But how the critical exponent change with changing the number of R?
Well, I think Kevin will show some plots about that, I guess.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Yes, it's here. Okay. they seem to converge.
The question is, if R squared is a fixed point, can one explore RG flow just nearby? Is there some? If R squared is a fixed point, as your calculations suggest, can you explore RG flow just nearby the fixed point?
Well, the it's R squared just when you sit at the fixed point and you do the whole integration of the modes. But if you want to be, say, a finite K and study what happens because then a finite K, you want to study perturbations around it. The action is more complicated. So it's not just an R squared. However, what we do in the sense of perturbation around the fixed point, as I was saying, is what that's the strategy to study critical exponents and so to look for what directions are relevant and so on. So, in principle, you like to identify the relevant directions and then study those, because those are what ultimately we are not at the fixed point, but we are on some relevant trajectory. So, that's what you would like.
You're saying it's not no simple calculation is possible.
Beyond this, no, not that I know.
Okay, so one final quick question, my lady.
Suppose you've managed to prove completely that gravity is asymptotically safe. Do you learn anything about whether gravity coupled to matter is also asymptotically safe?
I mentioned some. There's been some works in coupling the theory of matter, and the answer was still positive. You do get some constraints on the amount of matter you can put, so there are this is a function of number of Dirac fields or scalar fields and so on. You have some bounds on this. If you
it's
put too much
number of species that gets limited.
Excuse me?
It's just the number of species that gets limited.
Well, it's also limited by what has been done, which was I think mostly for this kind of analysis, free matter fields. I don't know, you know maybe more about the matter, but you're working now on the matter.
So you can also look at restrictions on the properties of matter, such as existence of paired chromosomes, and so far there are no restrictions that's compatible. But I think we're running really late, so let's
yes.
thank her again.
Yes, sure. I'm here anyway.
Okay, so it's really important for the last speaker before the session, before the coffee break, please don't run off with the microphone somewhere. Okay. So our next speaker is Tamaris, going to give us some more details on infinite dimensional truncations.
Okay, thank you, Astrid. Can you? Yeah, it sounds like the speaker's working. The microphone's working. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about this. I want to talk about two works here, which and Dario set me up very nicely. Thanks, Dario and Frank this morning. To about the context of this. So, the context in particular is about now keeping an infinite number of operators. You can think of it, roughly speaking, as all powers of the scalar curvature. However, because this is encoded in this function, we actually go beyond such polynomial expansions. We need to, in particular, find these functions, f of r, which are, we have to search the space of all of these possible functions for acceptable fixed points. Anyway, more about that later. So fortunately, thanks to the introductions to the subject from Frank and Dario, I can skip over the philosophy behind this, which, as I said, was introduced by Steve Weinberg, the idea that there could be a ultraviolet fixed point about which you recover a notion of renormalizability, but this time it's a sort of non-perturbative notion of renormalizability. The one point I would make is to remind you that this scenario relies on the idea that you have a suitable ultraviolet fixed point about which you have some finite number of relevant directions. Those relevant directions correspond to your couplings in this non-perturbative Wilsonian sense. So I'm going to skip all the details of the technology. I just want to emphasize four points. So we're going to use the exact renormalization group. So this is these functional renormalization group methods that have been talked about in the previous talks. And we are going to then make approximations to these effective flows of these effective actions. And the way the approximation goes is, as Dario explained, you introduce a background field, and then you use the background metric to project the action down to some simple form. And in particular, we're going to work on in Euclidean space on spaces of constant curvature, constant positive curvature, in other words, Euclidean four spheres. So we're going to work within a theory space in which we're working with just Euclidean four spheres. And if you do this, you can project the effective action as a function of the background metric down to just this form, so this f of r gravity type action, where this function is to be determined self-consistently by the equations, and it's a function of the scalar curvature and renormalization group time. So this is log of the scale of the effective cut of the effective cutoff scale k. If you do all that and you do as Dario sketched, you introduce ghosts and auxiliary fields and the whole technology. and you go through these approximations, eventually what you get is that the renormalization group flow boils down to a nonlinear partial differential equation for this function. And we'll be interested in trying to find acceptable solutions to this. By acceptable solutions, I mean functions which are non-singular as a function of these two variables. Now, the first paper that I mentioned was interested in trying to solve equations that people had already constructed. So the earliest equations of that type were constructed by Machado and Sarasig in 2007. And then very similar equations actually were constructed in 2008 by Codello, Picacci, and Remedi. And then last year in April, as Dario mentioned in the previous talk, he and Caravelli wrote down another set of equations. So three different realizations of this approximation. And as I say, the first paper was about how you solve those things. So to make life simple, I'm going to talk just about fixed points of those flows. So where this particular function actually is not doesn't depend upon the renormalization group time. It's just a function of the scaled curvature. I should have said everything is scaled here with appropriate powers, the cutoff. So curvature here actually means curvature divided by the square of the cutoff, effective cutoff scale. And of course, this is all important for the asymptotic safety scenario, these types of solutions, because if we find an acceptable such solution, that can be our ultraviolet fixed point about which we can then define the continuum limit of the theory. So why have these equations hung around for a while to be analyzed? Well, you can see here, these are the equations that Machado and Frank wrote down in 2007. And they're effectively equivalent to the ones by Codello et al. As well. The only difference is that in the Codello cases, well, there are some, the essential difference is that the theta functions that you can actually see embedded in the equation in various places, Heaviside theta functions, disappear because they adapted those equations specifically to the case where we're dealing with polynomial truncations. In other words, the limit in which the curvature becomes very small. But these theta functions will lead to technical complications, which I'm just going to skip over. They can be handled. The theta functions actually are inherited from the type of cutoff that was used that Dario sketched in general on the board here. This is Litten's cutoff. So the leaving aside, as I say, the theta functions, the other thing that you notice about these equations are that, well, they're very nonlinear, and they're actually third order ordinary differential equations. So the prime here is differential with respect to the curvature. So the question boils down to a mathematical question. How do we find acceptable solutions to this third order nonlinear ordinary differential equation? Now, one thing we know is that since it's a third order differential equation, around any particular value of the curvature r, we can develop a solution in the neighborhood of that particular value of the curvature, and we can find a three-parameter set of such solutions. Because it's a third-order ordinary differential equation, we know it depends upon three parameters. But because it's nonlinear of this type, you'll find that most of those solutions cannot be extended to global solutions over the whole space of four spheres. In other words, solutions that exist for all non-negative curvatures, you'll find that if you try and develop that numerically around any particular point, your three-parameter set of solutions, nearly all of those will die at some point where they hit some singularity. But furthermore, these equations also have so-called fixed singularities. Here's one where there's a pole at r equals 3, at scaled curvature r equals 3. And the reason this pole appears here has to do with the particular way that the cutoff profiles were implemented into the original theory. And we know, it's a standard undergraduate analysis, we know that such fixed singularities result in a reduction in the number of parameters in the equation. And to see that, take the differential equation, this third-order differential equation, and write it in normal form. So you isolate the third-order derivative, put everything else to the right. So this capital F here is a function of little f, its first derivative and second derivative, and R, and it's some regular function. And in this example, I've chosen the fixed singularity to be R equals zero. We're looking for solutions F which are regular, so we can substitute in particular a Taylor expansion around R equals zero. And then we see quite quickly that this fixed singularity enforces a constraint. So on the left-hand side, given that this is regular, its third order derivative is still regular. And on the right-hand side, we get some regular stuff, but this 1 over R gives us a piece that looks like this, where there's some function that we can work out of the first three parameters here. And in order for this to result in a regular solution for F, we see, therefore, that this piece has got to vanish. And so we get some non-trivial constraint on those three parameters, knocking it down to a two-parameter, two-dimensional space. Well, coming back to the equations, I've already noted there is a fixed singularity here. So that knocks us down. That provides one constraint on our three-parameter space. You see that just below it, there's another fixed singularity at R equals 4, so that's two constraints on our three-parameter space. And finally, if we look at the coefficient of the F triple primed here, if we were to write this in normal form, we'd have to divide by this coefficient. We see that indeed this also has a fixed singularity at R equals 0, and there will be a fixed singularity coming from this polynomial if it has a root, a non-negative root. And it does indeed have a non-negative root. It has a root at 2.0065 to five significant figures. So all in all, we have four constraints on this equation. Now, if this equation was of some beautiful type and had some underlying symmetries, you might hope that the constraints enforced by, say, this fixed singularity automatically solve the constraints that imposed by the others, but that's not true. These equations are of generic type, and these fixed singularities actually act independently. So we have, in fact, four constraints on our three-parameter space, which overconstrains the equations. So we can be quite confident that actually there are no global solutions to this equation. Now, to really back that up, this parameter counting argument, I should use those insights, go back and analyze these equations very carefully numerically. Rather than do that, I want to turn to some equations that at first sight, at least, look more positive. And those are Dario and Caravelli from last year in April. So one reason you can see that these look more promising is that the equation is much simpler. And that's to do with clever choice of the way that the ghosts and the auxiliary fields were treated in such a way that cancellations you would hope would happen eventually actually automatically happen here in this equation. And that results in the much of the simplicity. And the other thing that these authors did was to recognize that the problems with the previous equation come from these fixed singularities. And so they chose the way that their cutoff was implemented so that you avoided many of those fixed singularities. Well, you can see that in this equation, not all the fixed singularities are avoided. The coefficient in front of the F triple primed here, again, gives us a fixed singularity at R equals zero, and any root which is in positive root of this polynomial here, and again, there is one at 7.4150. So there are two fixed singularities on the expected three-parameter set of solutions, and that knocks us down to a one-parameter set. So now we can actually ask whether any of those one-parameter set of solutions actually survive to form global solutions. Remember, this is a nonlinear equation, so most of those solutions actually die at some singularity when you try and develop them numerically. If they do get as far as large R, then we can actually analyze this equation analytically in an asymptotic expansion. And this is the, if you do it carefully, you can get the most general asymptotic expansion of this equation, and that's listed here. So this carries on, but I've just listed the first two terms. So this is the bit that Dario was talking about before. For large R, for large scaled R, or for fixed physical curvature, when you let the effective cutoff scale go to zero and have done the full integral, the only bit that survives is this AR squared here. So one thing we can, I should say straight away, is that this capital A, for these to be physical at all, this capital A better be positive, so that when we Wick rotate back into Minkowski signature, these things are bounded from below. Well, the other thing that you can tell from this equation when you develop it is that once you get to large R, this asymptotic solution has no singularities in it, providing only that this cone condition applies on these three asymptotic parameters here. So if that cone condition applies, you know that once you get to large R and can trust this, you're safe to infinity and you found a global solution. The other interesting thing about this is, unlike the old days when studying, for example, local potential approximation in scalar field theory, the asymptotic behavior does not further restrict the dimension of the space. You actually have three parameters here. So the only things that are restricting the dimension of the space are these two fixed singularities. So the parameter counting argument tells you, therefore, that you should expect lines of fixed points from here. One parameter set of solutions that corresponds physically to lines of fixed points. So now we go away and look at this numerically using that insight. So what do I mean by that? So it means that to actually solve these equations numerically, you start, for example, you can start at R equals zero at this fixed singularity. And you know that if you do the expansion there as a Taylor expansion, you only have two parameters. So here's the third parameter already solved in terms of the first two in order to ensure that you have a regular solution. You expand that Taylor expansion to sufficiently high order that you can trust it and move away from the origin. And then you numerically integrate up to close to the next fixed singularity. And here you expand again in a Taylor expansion to sufficiently high order that you can trust it and match to your numerical solution, jump over the fixed singularity, and then once you're sufficiently far away, using the Taylor expansion, integrate again numerically out to infinity. And once you get to sufficiently large R that you can match in a trustworthy way onto this asymptotic expansion, you finally know you found a global solution. So that, roughly speaking, is how you do the numerics. And of course, you have to check all of those steps and check that the numerically that you trust the various parameters you've introduced, the distance away from the various fixed singularities and so on, and that nothing depends upon those. Anyway, having done that, let me show you what we found. So I'm going to plot the answers in terms of the parameters that you pick up at R equals zero. So you can think of this as, roughly speaking, the cosmological constant, and this is minus one over the Newton's constant. And we did indeed find lines of fixed points. So shown here are actually five such lines. Two of them form loops in this third quadrant here. And three of them form a fan shape in this first quadrant. Ignore the dotted lines. That's further technical aspects of how to find those numerical solutions that I don't have time to go into. And there are actually evidence for further lines. There's very probably an infinite set of lines of fixed points here. So one thing that's interesting and possibly troubling for the aficionados of asymptotic safety is that neither of these, first of all, you've got lines of fixed points rather than a single fixed point. But furthermore, none of these lines look already like the ones that you find in truncations. So in truncations, the solution is always found down here, positive cosmological constant and positive Newton's constant. And in fact, the only ones here that have a chance of being physically sensible are these lines here, because these correspond to a positive asymptotic parameter A, which you remember I said had to be positive for these to have a chance of being bounded from below when you put them back in Minkowski space, in Minkowski signature. Okay, so let me show you what these things look like. These black dots correspond to three example solutions, and they're plotted here in the same color scheme. and they're not very interesting to the eye, actually. This is a plot of f before the first singularity. This is a plot of these functions f of r after the first singularity, and these two match smoothly across the singularity. And to the eye, actually, it's difficult to tell the difference between this and purely r squared. There are some small deviations from that. So far, this would be a little bit problematic for the asymptotic safety scenario in the sense that we haven't got a single fixed point, but we've got these lines of fixed points. But it's worse than that, because when you go away and do the same sort of analysis on the eigenoperator spectrum, you find the eigenoperator spectrum isn't quantized. It's actually a continuous set of eigenoperators. So any scaling dimension you choose, you can find such an eigenoperator. Why is that a problem? It means that if any of these fixed points support a relevant direction, have, in other words, couplings that you have to take into account, it actually has a continuously infinite set of couplings. So that's certainly not very useful from the, thank you, asymptotic safety point of view. So what can we do about this? Well, one proposal that we tried is to recognize that quantum gravity, of course, must make sense on spaces other than just Euclidean four spheres. Quantum gravity must make sense, for example, also on negative curvature spaces. And furthermore, because of the implementation of the infrared cutoff in particular, if we're on a space with a very small curvature, vanishing curvature, quantum gravity shouldn't be able to tell whether it's a sphere, flat space, or a hyperboloid. So we should be able to match smoothly through topology change from spheres to flat space and to hyperboloids. And if you do that, you extend the theory space, and the counting arguments I just presented to you all change. So as an experiment, we decided to take Dario's equations again, and let's just analytically continue those equations, i.e. trust those equations, even for negative curvature. So they were derived explicitly on four spheres, but let's now extend this to all possible real curvature. And we're going to ask whether there are now regular solutions on this enlarged space, in other words, that match smoothly through r equals 0 into hyperboloids. And what you find is, of course, you find the same asymptotic solution, possibly with different coefficients b and c. But the interesting thing is that now fixed singularities, the number of fixed singularities change because there is a negative curvature fixed singularity here too. So I now have three fixed singularities on a third order differential equation, which tells me immediately to expect a discrete set of fixed points, a discrete set of solutions to this equation, which are regular everywhere. That's good news. That looks much more like what we were expecting. And when you do the same analysis on the eigenoperator spectrum, you now find they're quantized as well. So that's good news too. So that all looks rather nice, but we now have to go away now numerically and search for them, because this parameter counting argument doesn't tell you whether there are any solutions, just the sort of topology of those solutions space. Well, we did thorough numerical search, and unfortunately, we didn't find any global solutions this time. The best we could do is find one where one of those solutions, which existed for all positive curvatures, which could be continued into negative curvatures, get past the first singularity in the negative, fixed singularity on the negative side, and then it dies around about minus 8, and that's it. So there are no global solutions. But maybe we were being too optimistic. As I've emphasized, those equations were derived directly on four spheres, and there are all sorts of approximations and things that went into that which were special to four spheres, for example, the zero modes. And what we should really do is start again with hyperboloids, derive those equations, and match smoothly from spheres to hyperboloids to carry through that idea. Well, now I want to come to the second paper, and explained that actually it turns out there are ways of seeing that there was something wrong with those equations and their solutions directly in the space of four spheres without going through that idea, which is nevertheless consistent with that possibility that, that's the way the theory gets patched up. And that's to do with the breakdown of the F of R approximation itself. So how does that work? Well, it goes back to the concept of a redundant operator, which was introduced by Franz Wegener in 1974. So a redundant operator is an eigen operator, so an operator of a fixed, of definite scaling dimension, which is also equivalent to an infinitesimal change of field variable. And you can see intuitively that such an operator is not part of the physics. So if you were to consider renormalization group flows that go along this direction of this operator, all you're doing is reparameterizing the action. You're not doing anything physical. So it's important to identify the redundant operators and remove them from the argument. So that's what I'm going to do here. So the fixed point action, remember, takes this simple form. The eigen operators correspond to perturbations of this fixed point action. So they take the same form, but have a different name, V. And both of these things you have to solve self-consistently from those fixed point equations and the flow equations. And the question is, when is an eigen operator also redundant? So this operator is going to be redundant if it's equivalent to a change of field variable. So let's consider a small change of field variable. Of course, that's exactly what you would do in order to work out the equations of motion, given this F of R gravity. So you know that the eigen operator is therefore redundant if it can be written in this form, where here's the F, the perturbation of the metric, and here are the equations of motion for F of R gravity. But remember that we're working on spaces of constant scalar curvature. So in fact, these two terms here disappear. And for the same reasons, the only change of variables on the metric that I can consider are ones which are themselves just a function of the scalar curvature times the metric. So put all that together, and you get this equation that the eigen operator is, this is a sort of redundancy test, the eigen operator is redundant if it can be written in terms of some non-singular function of R times the equations of motion for constant scalar curvature. Thank you. There's the same equation. And so, as I said, we're interested in discovering whether there are solutions, zeta, which are regular in the natural domain, here the domain of positive curvature four spheres. So roughly speaking, you can think of these scalar curvature constant scalar curvature solutions to this equation of motion as a vacuum solution. It's not really quite correct for reasons I don't have time to go into, but let's just call it that anyway. So are there any vacuum solutions? If there are vacuum solutions to this equation, then the redundancy test says V is redundant if V also vanishes there. Since zeta is non-singular, that's forced by this equation. Well, what about our solutions? Well, we checked these solutions, which are the ones which have a chance of being physical, and we found that actually there are no vacuum solutions. So this thing never vanishes, and thus zeta is always defined. You simply divide by this. So for every eigen operator, it can always be written as a reparameterization, which means that there's no space left to consider the theory. In particular, there's an eigen operator which is just corresponds to perturbing the action along this line of fixed points. So every fixed point action on these lines are all equivalent to each other by reparameterization. And by global reparameterization, we can get from here to here, everything is equivalent to everything else. But unfortunately, theory spaces collapse to a point. There are no physical operators left to test the theory. So this is a sort of a complete collapse of the F of R approximation, and as a result of having no acceptable vacuum solution. Well, how can that be equivalent to the suggestion I made before of how we could patch up the theory, which was to consider the space, enlarge the space to include topology change? Well, it turns out that the same sort of asymptotic arguments I was showing before can be used to show that if there had been a fixed point solution on this enlarged space, then you would be guaranteed a solution to this equation. And given that, and the fact that the eigenoperators in this case, in any case, are a discrete spectrum, the requirement that the eigenoperator vanish at these points would overconstrain those equations. So generically, none of the operators can possibly satisfy this extra equation. All the operators are therefore okay, they're not redundant. So the two pictures match well together, but the essential conclusion is that there's something wrong still with these equations. So that brings me to, with 1 minute to go, to my conclusions. I think the main conclusion I want to make is that we are now in an era where we can push the asymptotic safety conjecture to the infinite dimensional, to spaces of infinite dimensional, infinite numbers of operators, and really start to make severe tests of this idea. And we have the technical advances that allow us to do that. Of course, we've seen that, unfortunately, the flow equations, the early flow equations, failed because there couldn't be any global solutions, and that had to do with the way the cutoffs were implemented. And it turns out that those equations from April of last year also have problems, but they're now somewhat more subtle. So the question is, are there ways of constructing these flow equations which are good enough to get global solutions? In other words, to verify asymptotic safety in this new regime. One aspect of this, of course, is then to understand how we avoid this breakdown of this F of R approximation. Now, my personal feeling is that that does come down to how we implement the approximations, and that at this level, the sort of approximations which were acceptable for truncations, polynomial truncations, need no longer be acceptable, and we have to be a little bit more careful with our approximations. There's another way in which we can avoid the F of R breakdown, and that's to go beyond F of R in the way that Dario indicated in his last transparencies, for example, by including the square of the Weyl curvature, or also in the way that Dario indicated, by including more of the theory. We've thrown away a lot of things. We've thrown away the ghosts, we've thrown away the auxiliary fields, and we've thrown away the fluctuation field. We need to keep these things, or parts of those things. If we do that, then again, you can argue that the approximation can never break down in the way that I've indicated. So that brings me to the end of my talk. Thank you. Cool. Sir.
Thank you first about this talk. Wasn't it obvious from the beginning that having two different answers for two different schemes, all right, wasn't that enough to conclude that there is something wrong with the truncation even without having going through this analysis? So thank you for doing all these sophisticated analysis, but wasn't that enough from the beginning to conclude that?
Well, what do you mean by two different answers? I mean, you expect that because we're making approximations, if we did everything exactly, using different schemes, we should get exactly the same answer. But because there are approximations all the way along here, you lose that, and the scheme dependent, you will see scheme dependence, but you would hope at least to see qualitatively the same.
Yeah, answer. But the physics shouldn't depend on the scheme at all. And when you tell me that some solution have problems with the global structure, the other doesn't, from this, I mean, yeah, at least you should conclude that.
No, okay. So look, so you mean in the sense that what I showed was, for example, on four spheres that you got lines of fixed points, whereas in the truncations you don't get lines. Right, so there is an intuition that goes along with that. In the case of truncations, you keep a polynomial in the curvature, and that automatically explores negative curvature. In fact, I should have said that. So when you look at truncations, as Kevin will talk about later on in the week, you're automatically actually incorporating the topology change I was talking about. Whereas within this analysis, you have to explicitly say, I want to enlarge my space. But in polynomials, you don't. By definition, the polynomial is well-defined on the left-hand side for negative curvatures as well. So you know, from that point of view, what we should have done is definitely go and look at negative curvatures. And then I found no solution at all. And you can say, well, okay, but that doesn't that show you that explicitly everything has gone wrong? Well, not really, because you know, when you look at polynomial truncations and you're exploring only small curvatures, then you find solutions. So what's happening here is we're exploring the regime of very large curvatures, which are essentially invisible to polynomial truncations. We're taking it to a new level where we're testing it, this idea, even more severely. Does that help to answer the question?
Yes.
Simple question. Is it consistent to look at negative curvatures leading on the sphere?
Negative curvatures on the sphere? No, exactly. So that, I criticized myself for exactly that reason. It was something we could do immediately. We had the equations, so it was a nice thing to do. But no, I think you should start again and derive the equations on the hyperboloid, and then you should check that those equations match into the spherical equations. That would be the right way of doing things.
But they're not compact. Sorry. You want to the manifold to be compact in this calculation, so it doesn't matter.
No, ultimately it doesn't matter. And by saying that they match smoothly, all I mean is that this function that you derive self-consistently, its Taylor expansion for small negative curvatures, the coefficients are the same as the Taylor expansion for small positive curvatures. That's the sense in which you walk from one space to the other.
So, naively, one would think that what we've seen right now is that any result which we get in polynomial truncation, it's highly unlikely to work if I work in a full like non-polynomial truncation.
With these equations, yes.
Okay, so should I believe anything which I hear about polynomial truncation? Should I believe in a fixed point? Should I believe in street relevant direction? Should I believe anything? Or everything is in question and the entire scenario actually...
I understand the question. I'm agnostic. I think you can look at it two ways. You can say the truncations, you know, there have been many, many truncations. You keep finding that there is a fixed point. And some people are very much believers and say the situation is settled. I think that you just have to keep trying more and more severe tests, and if they live up to those severe tests, and I wouldn't say that this has killed it. What this has told you is that you need to go back and think more carefully about these flow equations.
Okay, so the result which you see in polynomial truncation can be due to the fact that they are polynomial truncation.
Yes, there is also the other possibility, which is that the polynomial truncations find fixed points, and that's because the approximations were just not good enough. And when you have good enough approximations, suddenly you find nothing. Of course, that's also possible. So that's why I'm agnostic. I'm going to sit firmly on the fence.
So let me ask a question. So,
yeah.
So you discarded solutions by imposing that the effective vector should be bounded from below.
Yeah.
So it's not clear to me that this is a good criterion in any truncation, because you can't say whether all the operators you're neglecting stabilize the effective potential.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You could just be throwing away the fixed point solution that will be realized in the full space because you think it's unbounded in your truncation.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So we should have looked at the. It was a useful way of halving the work, but you're absolutely right. The loops are in the third quadrant. We ought to go back in principle, we should go back and check and see whether those can be extended into negative curvatures. That's also true. Yeah.
I also have a point about this. You're basically saying that F is unbounded. But if you compute gamma, then you have to include the volume as well. And the volume goes as 1 over r squared. So I think it's always, gamma is always going to be bounded because it is still a constant.
Yes, sorry, I don't mean that it's unboundedness for large r. My worry is that it should have a minimum. There should be a minimum value, I mean, just from a sort of naive, sort of a Hamiltonian framework, which again, maybe that's naive.
Why is that different from being down?
So I thought you were referring to it the way that it behaves for large r. So supposing for large r,
unbounded, right?
So supposing for large r, it goes like negative a. I see the point you're making. I think you want the Lagrangian to be bounded from below. But maybe
the Lagrangian contains the square root of G, and this is
okay. Maybe it's a good point to this, to shift the rest of the discussion to the coffee break. And let's thank to Miguel.
I should leave you with this.
For giving me the opportunity to talk here, and also all residents of Parameter for stability. So I titled the talk Entangling a Flow and Game Momentum. So I will not going into much larger truncations, but really have a closer look on more simpler truncations to see what are we really dealing with. So it is mainly based on the work with Nicolai Christiansen, Daniel Littem, Jan Pavlovsky from last year, and something which is still work in progress. Instead of Daniel, we work with a master student, Benjamin Knorr. He's very good, and he's really the one who solves the complicated equations which let us gain the momentum. So what are we talking about? So it's normalization group session. So in the normalization group, of course, it's about the resolution. So we go from low def, from infrared to high def UV. You go with your scale, it's always the scale. So this we know the technical part, or let's call it vertical, that's why it's a horizontal line. And then there's of course some kind of horizontal part of the resolution, which is now a vertical line, which with it I mean that really understanding what is the theory we are talking about. So first there's always, we have this normalization group scale K, which is a priori not a physical scale at all. So we put it somehow in, then it has to be connected somehow to the physical processes. And then, as Frank also told us, one matches it with a physical scale, somehow with intuition. So now also see if we can make a normalization group analysis in a system where we really have the physical scale in hand, so we can compare it and see if intuition is right or is it misleading. So quantum gravity is always easy to be misleading, so really check it. And then there's always the problem is this, we got this interacting field theory. We renormalize it, and everyone knows we renormalize the fields and the couplings. And it's also a question, should we distinguish it somehow? Is there a difference in it? So in the end, of course, it's a combined system. We have to calculate the observables, but if we can detangle this a little bit, can it help us? And then there is something which is a bit more technically, is that they have a fluctuating field and a background field. What's the difference? So it's also looking at high point. So we'll see. It's more technical, so it's also about the background dependence of the theory somehow. So stuff, and as we will hope to convince you, is if we try to solve this more technical issue, I will explain on the next slide, this will also help us to get our hands on the other questions which allows us a deeper look on the theory. So what do I mean with this difference? So as Dario already told us in his overview talk, is that we have in gravity system, we had only obviously the dependence of the effective action on the background field and the fluctuating field. And one want to evaluate this beautiful, short, and nicely looking flow equation, and one usually does it by going to a zero fluctuating field and just calculated on the background field. But as we see that we have on the left-hand side of the equation, we got the action, which now only depends if you set the fluctuating field to zero on the background field. But on the left-hand side, we need at least the second derivative of the full action with respect to the fluctuating field. And one usually closes the equation by substituting the variation with respect to the fluctuating field, with respect to the background metric, which is, of course, an approximation. And then we should try to go beyond it. And to do so, our way we choose is to really not calculate the flow of the full action, but to directly also evaluate the flow of the two-point function. So first, take the derivative with respect to the fluctuating field, and then take the flow equation. So with our words, we take the second derivative of the full flow equation with respect to H field, then set the fluctuating field to zero. And this is how it looks diagrammatically. So we got the flow of the two-point function, which now is still has the one loop structure, but now not only contains the full propagator, but also the full vertices. So where we also have to use some concatenation to some intuition for the vertices. So we just approximated by the Einstein-Hilbert truncation. So all the all the vertices are the ones one would get from the Einstein-Hilbert truncation. But of course, all this formalism can be extended to higher truncation to improve it. And let us first just answer the last question. So what happens if we now look at the two-point function of the graviton and not at the full action, only depending on the background fields? So we will still identify coupling and fields. So with our words, the running of the Newton coupling will be identified with the running of the field strength normalization of the graviton. And we will also discharge the momentum dependence we got in the two-point function, more or less. So this, of course, has a complex dependence on the momentum. But we will just say, OK, we keep Einstein-Hilbert. So we got only a quadratic part in the momentum at the constant part. And the quadratic part in the momentum gives us, by the derivative of the flow of the two-point function, the field strength normalization, anomalous dimension. And the constant part will give us the running of the cosmological constant. So now it's question. So now we got the system where we have the same number of couplings, the same number of degrees of freedom as in the normal background calculations from Einstein-Hilbert truncation. So does our system now look differently? So best to look at the flow diagram. So it has some features which remind us to the things we saw before. So we got the non-Gaussian fixed point in the ultraviolet. We got, of course, the Gaussian fixed point at 0, 0. Then, which is hard to get on the slide, so we scaled it. There's always a fixed point in the infrared for the cosmological constant going to minus infinity. But now the new feature from this flow, so we really just changed the truncation a little bit. So we actually didn't change the truncation. We just had just changed our look at the truncation. So how do we interpret it is that we now got an infrared fixed point at lambda 1/2, where usually the flows tend to diverge. So this different definition from the, instead of defining it by the zero-point function, defining from the two-point function, changed the sign of the flow. So it also shows a little bit that might be some intuition wasn't so correct or whatever happens now. So now we go to the infrared fixed point of positive cosmological constant, but still it might not be the end since this fixed point is highly unclassical. So there is still something, so anomalous dimension isn't small. There's still some work to do to go further there. So now is the question, how can we enhance this first step? So the first step is just the third point. Was just the third point of the three I wanted to resolve. So just see how we can answer the other two. So if we had now the flow TT, so it's the left hand side of the right hand side of the flow equation. So of course has a more complicated momentum structure as we could resolve with our just 2-point projection. So we really see that it's very different to constant plus p squared, especially for large p. Of large momentum, it goes to a constant, so it's really is totally different behaviors you would expect from Einstein-Hilbert, so we can't cover it in our truncation. So we have to find a way to really close the flow in the momentum, from the momentum point of view. And the best thing is to do is null. So instead of just a constant for the wave function normalization, we equip the graviton with a momentum-dependent wave function normalization. So everywhere we had the graviton before, we just have now Z of P or Z of Laplace times H. So we got the momentum-dependent wave function normalization, from which we, of course, can define momentum-dependent anomalous dimension for the graviton field. And now, if you just change the graviton, and we will also do it for the ghost, and still keep Einstein-Hilbert truncation, then, of course, the two-point function will be, besides some tensor structure, just p squared minus 2 lambda times the momentum-dependent field strength normalization. And this, of course, now also appears on the left-hand side of the flow equation. And we are now somehow a little bit further than Einstein-Hilbert, since there is this extra momentum dependence. And if you now look at the flow equation for the two-point function, we can still calculate the running of the cosmological constant. And now we can also calculate the anomalous dimension. But what it's now a little bit more obvious, we don't really get the running of the of Newton's coupling. So before we got the Newton's coupling from the running of the field strength normalization by looking at a specific point in P, but now it gets more, you see it is more ambiguously, since there's a dependence on P, which the coupling, of course, won't have. So now the best thing is, of course, to get the running of the Newton's coupling from another correlator. So the ideal would be to keep in, to stay in the same formalism, to just now say the three-point function is an interaction which will get us the coupling, or we can combine our expansion in vertex with the standard heat kernel expansion, so which is done in background flow or in the geometrical flow, which we used in this particular instance, to really get a running of the coupling. And now, of course, the interesting question is, how do the anomalous dimension look like? So as I said, we also did it for the ghost, so included both. So this is a, so first maybe in the middle, so this is close to the ultraviolet fixed point we find. So it's maybe not long enough. So the anomalous dimension now goes to zero for large P, since the flow goes to zero. So this property still survives. So the anomalous dimension of the graviton vanishes for large values of the field. The ghosts, we don't see this behavior, so it's really a cancellation due to the tensor structure. And we can do it also for now arbitrary points, more or less, to get the flow. And what, of course, also shows us that we now resolve the difference between the field and the coupling is that this anomalous dimension close to the fixed point isn't at all close to minus 2. So this minus 2, one usually sees for the anomalous dimension, is actually the anomalous dimension of the Newton's coupling, which has to be 0, so the Newton coupling doesn't run. But we don't identify, so this is really another anomalous dimension as one usually looks at. So that's why it's also try to make it visible that it's eta h and not eta n. So these are the difference. So I hope I showed you that at least we could partly answer this question. So we now are on our way to really got some momentum dependence, which we can later also use for enlarged truncation. So if you really have a R square terms or F of R, then of course this is a more or less the first step to go to the momentum dependence. difference of the field between fields and coupling is also resolved, but still we might also look at the flow of the three-point function to really do everything in the same formalism, not combining it with feed kernel. And yes, of course, the difference between fluctuation in the background, where one could also look more on different vertices, and there we could also look at, which are now also starting, is looking at the difference between the different modes of the graviton, which don't have to behave the same. So we could equip them with different anomalous dimensions. And this is what I want to. Thank you.
Have you thought about solving the equations for negative p squared? Because you could answer, in principle, you could answer various questions about unitarity, couldn't you, if you went to negative p squared to see whether there were.
In principle, it could work. Also, brought it. So it's at least for. So around, we don't have see any singularity at zero or something, so it should be more or less smooth. So we can also go to negative, but there's of course the question how good it is if there are still some problems inside this truncation or in the simplification if you go to negative. This not the, we also looked for negative, but the interpretation is still not 100%. If there's so we won't be too sure. But in principle, we got solutions for negative p, and so it goes on consistently. But it's
negative p squared.
Yeah. So it's just that plotted over p, it's just mm-hmm. the number.
Further questions? So can you go back to your slide 6? I think it was. So it's not quite clear to me the projection rule that you're using to project onto the wave function denormalization. When you're evaluating that as p equals to k, it seems to me you're not really projecting on the p-factor of the anti-Hilbert term, but you're really including the effect of higher curvature terms,
yes.
And you're projecting on some kind of mixture, so you shouldn't at all interpret it in the same flow diagram as usually, because you're projecting on some superposition of higher order couplings.
It's well, it's the closest thing we get to the complete projection.
So
we got to
zero. Then you're looking precisely at that term.
Yeah, we already. Yeah, this is really. One might really not call it the G. So it's really the combined of the higher derivatives. But in the end, on a fixed point, we need the combination. So we also need the contributions from the higher terms. So one might even, so maybe this is really the reason why we got real exponents. So we are, so if the complex, it always means that you got not the right coordinates. So maybe so now the coordinates are automatically shifted, so to speak. It might be connected with, that we include these terms, which we normally only see if you go to higher polynomial truncations with real exponents.
Would that happen if you choose
p with 0? This doesn't work so good, to be honest. Mainly, this is also the reason why we really looked at the full momentum dependent.
So what exactly
do
you mean by not so good?
Yeah, so taking the derivative. So there's really some ambiguities we found at parts. So for taking the derivative or defining it differently and so on. So it's not 100% defined. So that's why it's really also the problem to really not try to use it to define the running of G, the two-point function. So really makes a difference and look at our functions. Yeah.
Good, then let's thank all the speakers of the session again. And the session starts up with a coffee break in half an hour, so 20 to 5.
Well, giving me an opportunity to talk here and also all residents of Parameter for stability.